Chapter 46. Davin, wake up. It was Ariane's voice, and were it not for the light of a morning sun he could sense behind his eyelids, he would have figured himself stuck in a dream. If Ariane were in it, it was likely a good one. He'd been so bone-weary after the toils of the last 2 days that he had fallen into his bed inside the palace without so much as removing his boots. A hand took his.
Davin, wake up, my love. We need you.
We? He forced his uncooperative eyes to open, squinting. The curtains of his window had been pushed aside, sunlight bathing everything in a warm hue. He blinked to clear his vision and squeezed the hand in his. Ariane. He sat on his bed, flanked by Ki on her right and Tar to her left. Elaine stood behind, face troubled and threatening to burst into tears. He inhaled to clear his lungs, broken ribs punishing him for the effort, though they didn't seem as painful as they had been the day before. With effort, he pushed himself to a sitting position, fending off the sleep that still drugged his thoughts. By the slant of the sun, it was well past mid-morning. He needed to be off to scout northward.
Really, brown man, Key said during the silence, you should not sleep so deeply in times of trouble. The door squealed like a wounded boar when we entered, and you didn't so much as twitch. I could have skewered you in your sleep.
Davin put his other hand over Ariane's and looked her over. Her dirty face and unkempt hair told the tale of a long, late march, and someone had cut off the very bottom of her dress. The twin sisters fared better, though he knew their conditioning gave them greater resilience. It seems the three of you need to trade me places on the bed. Davin craned his neck around to get a better look at Elaine. And how are you, Miss Brighton?
Awful, Baron Carver, she said, lip quivering. My parents have been arrested. The Queen is dead, and Ariane tells me that I shall have to call you brother instead of husband.
Davin stood slowly, heart pounding.
The Queen is dead?
Yes,
Ariane said, tears welling in her eyes.
They found her this morning. She passed in her sleep.
He could hardly believe it.
This is awful. What a dreadful time to lose her.
Lord Ember dead? Queen Philippa dead? Powerful nobles arrested on charges of treason? A massive army bearing down on them from the north? He paced the room, oblivious to everyone for several moments, his mind trying to grind out a useful way to deal with the crisis. But a sob pulled him from his ruminations.
Ariane.
The Queen was her dear friend. He returned and sat by her, pulling her to him while she mourned. Elaine dissolved into tears and Davin raised an arm, inviting her to him and embracing her as well. He found his own cheeks wet, and several minutes passed under the cloak of sadness. Ki and Tar looked on gravely.
We must tell him,
Ki finally prompted. Ariane pulled away and wiped her eyes.
There is something you need to see at the Flame Cathedral, Davin. It is extraordinary. It has to do with your carvings.
Davin looked at her neck and wrist. Her carvings were missing. He turned to Ki and Tar.
And your birds?
Gone,
Tar answered.
And my saber cats,
Elaine blubbered. Davin rubbed his neck.
Where did they go?
Ariane rose and took his arm, wincing as she stood.
It would be easier to show you.
Are you well?
Davin asked her.
My feet are bruised and blistered beyond recognition. I'm afraid the shoes in which I chose to face death are not very good for walking to Belshire in the middle of the night. Ki has already applied a salve, but it will take time. I would ask you to change into a sabre cat so I could ride you, if I didn't think it would scare the mob.
Davin pulled open the door. The sunlight in the building a welcome relief from the oppressive darkness of the night before.
A mob?
Yes, she answered. Both come to mourn the Queen as well as gather round the Flame Cathedral.
They left the palace proper, the gathered crowds thronging the palace and the Flame Cathedral. The crowd reminded Davin of something he had forgotten.
Ariane, your name has been cleared.
She smiled. Yes, I know. I spoke with the Under-Sheriff when we arrived early this morning. It is the only good news he had for us.
Has the Queen's will been read? He asked.
Not yet,
she replied, fiddling with her hair.
It will be presented in the House of Lords this afternoon. I think they're still trying to determine how many nobles they will arrest. If the Queen has chosen someone who was one of the conspirators, the succession will come to a vote. Since most of the nobles implicated in the traitorous scheme are from the north, it is quite possible our new monarch will be from the south. They pushed through the noisy throng, making their way up the steps to the Flame Cathedral. The crowd here was thicker still, and the guard had to push and shove to keep curious people from the building proper. Kian Tar elicited a lot of wide-eyed looks from the men and women alike, though the two sisters just smirked at the attention. The door to the inside of the cathedral was open, and members of the House of Light spoke to one another inside, eyes alight with wonder. Mr. Goodwin leaned against the door, beckoning to Davin and his party. Davin presented his palms to the guard, and they let him and his companions pass. Davin smiled and shook Mr. Goodwin's hand.
"How are you, Mr. Goodwin?"
"I'm not dead, so not as good as I would like. Good morning, Lady Hightower, and Barbarian 1 and 2.
Mr. Goodwin's drawn face looked like it had spent the night camped at death's door, though a lively white rose stuck through his lapel to mock exhaustion of his frame. His face brightened quizzically when his eyes fell on Elaine.
"And who is this little ray of sunshine?"
"This is my sister," Ariane explained. "Miss Elaine Brighton."
"Forgive me for staring," he said. "You remind me of someone, miss. Do you like flowers?"
"Yes, of course," Elaine answered meekly. Mr. Goodwin pulled a flower from his lapel and handed it to her.
"Then do me the honour of caring for this one. It certainly will be more at home with you than me."
"Thank you," Elaine said, taking the rose. Such a tender act from such an irascible man took Davin aback for a moment. While Elaine seemed a little embarrassed, Mr. Goodwin's countenance brightened, the slack lines on his weary face disappearing as if he had just rested for several hours. Mr. Goodwin coughed.
"Well, drag yourself in here, Baron Carver. This is all your fault, I'm sure. We found all the members of the House of Light that we could, though no one knows what to make of this."
All the flame touched, men and women that could be gathered, had assembled in the chamber where Joris Pulsifer's now flameless cooking pot sat on the stone platform. But the pot was not empty. Piled high within it were his carvings, all jumbled about in a heap. Davin released Ariane and walked forward tentatively, while the gathered flame touched hushed into silence. He stooped down before the pot, thoughts mired in amazement. They were all there. Queen Philippa's arrow asp staff, the saber cats, the candles, the finches, Mr. Goodwin's flower, Ariane's jewellery, everything he had carved and gifted, everything but one.
"How did they get here?" Davin asked.
"They came of their own accord," Ariane explained, stepping forward. "They practically pulled their owners here, and if the owners wouldn't come, they dragged themselves. Are they all here?"
"All but one," Davin answered. "I carved something for the late Lord Ember."
A gasp of astonishment cut him off as the crowd parted. Walking toward the platform was the likeness of Lord Ember that he had carved and gifted to him what seemed an age ago. It was barely 8 inches tall, but it strode forward fluidly without haste as the flame touched looked on.
"You carved these?"
a dark-haired woman from the crowd asked Davin.
"I did.
It was my gift."
"And what is their purpose?"
she pressed.
"I thought they were merely gifts," he answered, standing.
"I cannot be sure of what this means at present."
In utter silence they waited as the stately figurine of Lord Ember completed its long walk toward the pot burgeoning with carvings. Davin stepped back, taking Ariane's waist and pulling her next to him. A warmth was filling him, an anticipation of something good, just as powerful as his dread had been the night before. His heart beat with the vigour of youth, a flood of joy washing away all the worry and darkness that had overcome him that morning. The figurine arrived at the pot and jumped, catching the rim and pulling itself up. It ascended to the top of the pile, standing on the back of one of the saber cats. Slowly, it raised its arms, and Davin felt the warmth within him rise to the level of burning. Ariane glanced at him and then pulled away, hand on her mouth. The figurine burst into flame, astonishing everyone. The carvings beneath the tiny Lord Ember took up the fire,
the conflagration in the pot rising in the air until it was as tall as Davin. A fiery tendril shot out like a whip, hitting Davin squarely in the chest, burning through his coat and shirt. The force knocked him down, but there was no pain, only joy. One by one, the memories of gifting each carving flashed through his mind along with the emotion of the one who received it. The chamber faded for a moment as peace and contentment suffused him to the point of bursting. It was as if every pain was purged, every mistake a forgotten memory.
Davin?
Ariane again. He opened his eyes. She knelt by him, holding his hand. The strength of the joyous feeling faded, but the cleansing of the fire remained with him. He came to his feet and took stock of himself. His ribs had healed. He felt rested. He felt at peace. Ariane stared at him in wonderment.
Are you well, Davin?
He took her hand.
Never better.
You were glowing for a moment, she said. Come, see.
She led him forward to the pot where the eternal flame again burned cheerily in its humble home. They joined the crowd reverently watching its tongues of flame flick about in the morning light, grateful for the return of what they thought forever lost. Ariane released his hand and began fumbling at the buttons of his shirt. Davin felt the red rise in his cheeks.
I am unharmed, Ariane, he assured her. I know.
She pulled away the shirt. There, on top of the three sabercat scars, was seared the mark of the eternal flame. Ariane spun him around.
This man is no longer Baron Carver, but Lord Ember, chosen by the eternal flame. If you are flame-touched, kneel before him.
And they did. Davin felt sick. One of the Undersheriff's goons belted Melkor in the face. The Cretesian spy grimaced at the blow. The recently killed Lord High Sheriff had possessed a more powerful swing, he was sure. The goon's bonier fist hardly carried enough weight, though after an hour of pounding and threats, Melkor thought his body might have simply become accustomed to the pain. Cretus routinely used more sophisticated torture techniques. What the Bitamarchians offered could hardly call itself more than a back alley beating behind a tavern. His vision still blurred and swam. The snake's venom, even an incomplete dose, had nearly crippled him. His stomach felt like someone was inside him, mashing it with a booted foot. That hardly mattered now that it was empty, though the dry retching still hurt his throat and head when his stomach demanded more convulsions. The small stone room where they violently questioned him smelled of his vomit, vomit that the rotted hay on the floor did little to absorb. His leg had swollen into a puffy black and blue wreck. It throbbed, feeling like the fluid inside it might explode out of the skin at any moment. He would be thankful if it did.
Was the Cretesian ambassador in on this scheme of yours?
The Undersheriff, Higgins, was it, asked for the 16th time. Melkor was counting. It helped him endure the pain. The policy of the Cretesian fists was never to answer any question under duress. So as he had for the last hour that morning, he simply grinned, until the goon punched him again. This blow compressed his midsection. The dull pain actually helped mask the spasming discomfort of his stomach, for which he mentally thanked his bloody-knuckled tormentor.
Did you know Baron Longford? Did you work with him?
The Undersheriff demanded. Melkor believed this only the eighth time this particular question had come around. His swollen tongue tried to lick the caked blood off of his lips, but his dripping nose kept supplying more. At least the blood kept his mouth moist. His spit had long since failed him. Even if he wanted to spill all his secrets, he wasn't entirely convinced his throat could produce more than raspy grunts. The goon readied his fist for another blow, but the Undersheriff raised a hand and pulled him up short.
Halt! Let him spend a little time with one of his conspirators to see if that will loosen up his tongue.
The lanky Undersheriff and his thug left the cell. While his blurry eyes couldn't be sure, the light from the small grate on the wall indicated that morning had long since come. He hardly cared. He had failed in his mission, though he held out hope that the Cretesian army from the north would finish the work for him. They had no love of nobles or monarchs, and they were under orders to spare none of them alive. Melkor squirmed in the firm wooden chair, testing the strength of the bonds around his raw ankles and wrists. Pain lanced up his limbs as the rough ropes scratched burning grooves into his skin. The goon might not be able to throw much of a punch, but he tied a good knot. Exhausted, Melkor slumped, letting his head hang and his cramped muscles relax. With an envenomed leg twice its normal size, and a stomach that would immediately eject any substance put into it, his chances of escape were slim. How long would they keep him alive? Would they even give him a trial? He doubted it. With war afoot, they would likely order a very public execution and be done with it. Melkor knew his only hope was that Cretesian forces would seize control of Belshard and free him. How long that would take, he could only guess. Still, members of the Fist did not talk when tortured, and the Under-Sheriff of Belshire might find a Cretesian operative of more use drowned in the river than silent in a cell. The door creaked open. Two of the Sheriff's men entered and hoisted his chair off the ground, carrying him out. They were far burlier than the bony-fisted goon. Why hadn't Under-Sheriff Higgins turned them loose on a Cretesian spy? Maybe that was coming next. But that wasn't the plan at all. The Under-Sheriff's men took him down the dark dungeon hallway to a separate cell, setting him down inside. A corpse slumped in the corner where a weak shaft of sunlight could illuminate its bloated features. Under-Sheriff Higgins was already inside.
"Here's your good friend, Baron Longford," the Under-Sheriff said, trying to be snide.
He wasn't good at it.
"Enjoy his company for a while. He won't be going anywhere. Not only is he dead, but only Baron Carver can carry him around. Strange. You know anything about that?"
Only Baron Carver could carry the corpse? More Bittermarchian superstition. As for Baron Carver, Melkor wanted to tie that man up in a dark cell for an hour or two. Then the goon could watch and see how a real interrogation was done. The retinue left, clanging the door shut. Melkor grinned, caked blood cracking and flaking from his lips as he did. Such infantile tactics. Did they really think that a member of the Fist could be broken using the look-at-the-corpse-of-a-co-conspirator technique? He had probably seen more corpses than all the sheriff's men combined. The Under-Sheriff was clearly an amateur. Melkor squinted at his new cellmate to get a better look. His eyes simply would not focus properly. But this could not be Baron Longford. He was far too big. Or maybe his blurry eyes simply inflated the size of the corpse in the corner. The Baron's face didn't seem quite right either, but it was too unclear to make a determination. Curse the Queen's arrow asp. He hadn't quite figured out how she had managed that little piece of trickery. Resigned, Melkor closed his eyes. There was nothing to do but wait for the booming of cannon shot and the staccato of gunfire to signal that his fellow Cretesians had arrived. How he longed for that sound. Perhaps in the thick of battle, the Under-Sheriff would forget about him. Maybe the effects of the arrow asp's poison would fade more quickly than he thought they would and return his body to working order. He exhaled, bruised muscles and ribs aching with each in and out of his breath. He thought he heard a trickle of water from somewhere. How he could use a drink. Even if his stomach just launched it back out, it would at least get the taste of blood out of his mouth. While bile was certainly no great improvement over blood, the variety would do him good. The pain in his leg lessened, bringing relief. It was as if he had planted the swollen appendage into a cold mountain stream. A tingling, cleansing sensation crept up his body, soothing his hurt and unclenching his stomach. His eyes flicked open. What was happening? He blinked. His vision no longer swam or blurred. It was the Baron Longford, opposite him, his pale, lifeless face angled toward the light. Melkor would have sworn the corpse bigger just moments ago. A clean stretch of floor between him and the Baron caught his attention. The dirty straw had been washed aside, a channel of water seeming to flow from the Baron toward his foot. His bodily pains continued to fade, but an uncomfortable pinching sensation briefly stung his chest and his palms, jolting him upright. Then he began to swell. At first it felt unpleasant, like there was too much water and too little skin to contain it, but the feeling was replaced by one of power, of unconquerable strength. The ropes at his ankles and wrists snapped. The form-fitting servant's garb he had donned as a disguise ripped asunder, no longer able to contain his bulging body. Hands now free, he stretched, bringing them around so he could see why his palms had stung before. There, on his palms, was inscribed a wavy line. The same line ran across the centre of his bare chest. He stood dumbstruck. It was impossible. The primal forces were a lie. A rat skittered out from under a mound of mouldy hay, sniffing the air as if sensing some kind of change. Crush it. Melkor turned his head about, wondering where the command had come from. It almost sounded like his own voice. No one was with him save the dead Baron. There was a soldier outside the door, he was sure, but the order to crush the rat seemed to come from inside him.
Crush it, and I will show you a way out of this prison.
It was inside his head, but it wasn't him. Was it madness? Poison? The primal water? Did the elements speak? Would they help him? He shook his head to clear it. Maybe the arrow asp's poison had finally addled his brain and sent him into the arms of insanity. Still, he was free, and he no longer hurt.
Do it now!
The rat sniffed about the Baron's corpse. With a quick step and a downward stamp, Melkor crushed the vermin, the crack of its snapping bones barely audible beneath his massive foot.
Good. Now do not cry out. There is one last ritual.
A host of rats, 10 at least, flooded out of a small grate in the wall. Melkor watched, transfixed, as they scurried over and surrounded his now bare feet. Then all at once they dove in and chewed at his ankles. More than any beating he had taken before, the awful chewing of the rats on his flesh prompted him to cry out, but he stifled it. And in a moment it was done, the rats retreating back through the grate. He lifted his legs, expecting to find blood and ripped flesh. But instead a grouping of odd runes surrounded his ankles.
Now hurry. There is more that must be done. Your victory is still within reach.
Melkor realized that the dead Baron's clothes were unusually big for the corpse they covered. Melkor stripped them off of his body. Crazy or not, he would get away from this prison if he could. And if some strange voice in his head wanted to lend aid to his cause, he would take it.